at Genesis chapter 10, and my title for it for this evening is The Origin of Nations. Now, when you look at this chapter, you can see obviously there's a lot of names. I believe there are about 70 names here, and some people make bring a thought out from that by the perfection which 70 involves. I'm not going to go down that route myself this evening, but just to say a little bit about some of these verses, because they are really quite interesting. They are, in fact, very interesting for a number of different reasons. And there are lessons, just like there are in every part of Scripture, there are lessons for us to learn. And if we only dig a little bit deeper, well, we can find out what these things are. And there are a lot of things here, but I'll just mention a few. This chapter shows to us the origin of nations, as I've mentioned, that the great nations of the ancient world, well, you can trace them all, even here to Noah and to his sons. Some of these kingdoms, well, they are no more. Babylon, for example, it's we're going to mention a little bit about Babylon. But Babylon is no more, and other kingdoms as well. But many others, well, they're still around. Ethiopia, Greece, maybe not always in the same place as they were originally in that ancient time, but still a reference to these great nations. Egypt, that is still with us today. Israel, of course. So I'll mention some of these nations as we are going through it, but don't worry. I'm not going to go through every name and every country that originates from here. It's very interesting actually to me. I like it, and maybe one or two of you do. But otherwise, it'd be a bit tedious to do that in a Bible study. But for personal study, it's actually quite an interesting study to do. And another thing about this chapter, and really maybe the essential thing about it, is the focus that it focuses on. It hones in, it highlights Eber, the son of Shem, or really we should say the great-grandson of Shem, because he's not actually his direct son. And Moses, it seems, is in a bit of a rush. And he's here in verses 2 to 5, he mentions the families of Japheth. And then in verses 6 to 20, he hurries through, as it were, the families of Ham. It's as if he can't wait to get to Eber and the sons of Shem. Well, obviously, as you've said before, it's because that's the godly line. That's the line through whom Christ Jesus is eventually going to come. And so he wants to get to that point quickly. And that's why also we read here in verse 21, unto Shem also the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder. As I said, Eber was his great-grandson, not actually his son. But right from the very start, when he's mentioning the children of Eber, he brings before our attention, the children of Shem, he brings before our attention Eber, so that he is at the forefront, because through him specifically, the Jews are going to come, and through him, the Messiah is going to come. So Shem, Eber, and then Abraham. We're going to trace the history of Abraham, and how he then, we follow him into the land of Egypt, and then how he comes back, the Israelites come back, brought back through the wilderness, and then they occupy that land of Canaan, and they're there for a number of years, and then they go into exile in Babylon because of their sin. We trace them there with Jeremiah and Daniel and so on. And then when they come back into their land, well, we trace them again right up until the coming of Jesus Christ. We're following that one family and that one thread of the Scriptures, because that's the vital thing. That's the focus of it. And so all these other nations, well, they're important, they're mentioned, but really in connection with Israel. So when we come across it, most of the time, it's in relation to the history of Israel. So chapter 10 And chapter 11 is critical for us because it links the prophecy of Noah and that blessing that we looked at in our previous study that is upon Shem, and it connects him with Abraham. So 10 and 11 joins all these two things together, so we can see how God's word also and God's prophecy has come to pass. Now, as we look at this chapter, and just briefly tonight, we should keep in mind that the events of chapter 10 actually happened after the scattering of the people in chapter 11. Chapter 11 and what happened at Babel, which we look at, God willing, in our next study. Well, that happened, that preceded this division and this actual scattering of the people into different parts of the world. I'll say a bit more as we go on. So verses 2 to 5, we have the nations that come from Japheth. And this group of peoples, well, they occupied the largest land space. From Gomer, we have the Gomerites, and they branched westward into places even like France and Spain. And according to Josephus, the people in Galatia in the times of the New Testament, where we get our book Galatians, they were initially called Gaul people. And before that, they were called Gaul. They were known as Gomerites. And so they settled in that area, and they also moved further afield into those parts of Europe. They even came to Ireland. They even came to settle in Wales. So we know this because if you look at the Welsh language, apparently, I didn't know this, but the Welsh language is called Gomereg, which is from the Gomer himself. So there is a connection there. Not British Israelism, that's something completely different, but there is some connection there. From Madai, the next, another son, where that's where we get the Medes, where we read off again in Daniel and Jeremiah. We read a lot about the Medes and the Persians. Eventually they joined together with the kingdom, joined forces with the Persians to become one kingdom. And today that equates to the nation of Iran. Javan, well, Javan is Greece. And if you look at every occurrence of Greece in the Old Testament, you'll see that the Hebrew translation is Javan. So all these things is confirmed to us. But verse 5, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. The isles of the Gentiles here, it refers to those places that were beyond the Mediterranean Sea, countries that were accessible by sea, such as the lands that I've mentioned here already. And in Isaiah 42, verse 4, this phrase again is found regarding the isles. And it's where the Lord is talking about his servant. And he says, his servant, he shall not fail, nor be discouraged, till he have set judgment in the earth, and the isles shall wait for his law. A prophecy of the gospel that's coming to the Indo-European lands. And so a wonderful, very specific prophecy for us. But then notice, even in this verse, that the division, friends, is not a disorderly one. That the division which happened after Babel, it was not a confused scattering of people who didn't know where to go, and everyone just broke up and went their own way and did their own thing and just tried to find a spot where they could settle and with their families. That's not how it happened. It may seem like it when you read chapter 11, especially because Babel means confusion, but that's not actually how it happened. There is a very strong suggestion here that it was all done in an orderly way, according to what God had planned, according to what God had put in place, and God had determined. And it seems that God had determined beforehand where each of these families should live, where each group should be heading out to. And it was meant to be done and it was done eventually in an orderly way. So there's very good reason to believe that. When you look here at the mention even about Eber, it's thought that in verse 21 it was through Eber that this plan of God was communicated. We cannot be say for sure. We cannot be 100% certain about it, but it does seem that God had passed on this information to the people that they should go to these different places. Before he told them, and we looked at that in Genesis chapter 9, verse 1, and they came out of the ark, replenish the earth. That was the mandate given to Adam, and it was renewed again with Noah. Go out and replenish the earth. But in addition to that, they were also told where to reside. And we can see this in, if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 32 and verses 7 to 8. These are Moses' words to Israel in the wilderness. Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask thy father, and he will show thee. Thy elders, and they will tell thee. And then listen to this. When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the people of Israel. So, friends, that's not that division, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, that's not really talking about the division of Canaan to the different tribes, but it's referring here to the division of land to the division of the world to the different families mentioned here in chapter 10. And then again in the New Testament, Acts 17:26, God hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation. God, friends, has already determined and mapped out the borders of nations. And it seems to be what was in place here, which when you read Genesis chapter 11, it makes even more sense. Here they are. God has told them to go out, not only to all the other different parts of the world, but to particular places, and yet they rebel. And yet they go against what God has said. So the division and the scattering that took place after Babel, well, it happened here, we can see, according in an orderly way, because it happened after everyone, after his tongue, after their families in their nations. Families were kept together by language. God could have, when he brought that a number of languages at Babel, he could have separated families. He could have had a husband and a wife speaking different languages, or parents and children speaking different languages. But God didn't do that. The families were kept together and allowed to speak the same language together. And so wherever they went, they could still have that communication with each other. And as a society, wherever they went, they could work together and function together, because that same language was still there. In the kindness of God and the goodness of God, these things happened. And it wasn't just a total confusion, as if no one knew what they were doing. So a wonderful mercy, I think, of God in determining and arranging these things for them. Even in the judgment that came upon them, he is merciful. Well, friends, a little bit of an application for us is let God determine where we live. If he chooses where nations should be and where nations should stand, we must always seek him. Where should I live? It's a very simple application. Where should I be? We leave that in God's hands, because he knows. And where he appoints for us the best place to be, whether it's in cold England or a sunny land in the Far East or somewhere, or in any other place, well, that is the place where God determines is the best place for me to be. Well, verses 6 to 20, we have the families of Ham, Cush, that's Ethiopia. In the Bible, always, again, if you look at the word Ethiopia, you'll see in Hebrew it's Cush. Mizraim, in another son, is Egypt. And then we have Canaan. Canaan, as you know, was cursed because of his sin. And his descendants here are listed in verses 15 to 18. And we're familiar with them because we've read so much about them when we read Joshua and so on. Verse 15, the Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, and so on and so on. All those groups of people who were occupying Canaan, and they were occupying it, and before Israel went in and took possession of it. And so these are the ones, they originated from here before, and they lived in Canaan before they were driven out by Joshua. Well, the name that stands out in this list, of course, of Ham's sons and grandsons is this man, Nimrod, the son of Cush, verse 8. Cush begat Nimrod. The name Nimrod means a rebel. And he was a mighty one. We read here, he was one who stood out from the crowd. While the others, it seems, were somewhat happy to just acquiesce to the things of the time and the fact that people just lived under the heads of the families, a sort of like a patriarchal system. Well, he wanted something more than that. And it was ambition that drove him on. He wanted to excel other people. And that's what he did. He did excel other people in his hunting and in his achievements. Well, he was a mighty warrior. And he was, as we see here, also a kingdom builder. He built these big and great. He's like a person who's not satisfied with just being with a small thing. He wants more and to conquer more and more lands. He's like an ancient Napoleon who wants to gain more and more territory. And he comes across in this way, seeking to excel and to spread abroad his power. And most likely he won the admiration of the people. When they saw him doing what he did, they liked it. They were for him. And we read here also that he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now that's probably not said in an approving way of him, as if the Lord was happy with him being so, but because his name was a rebel, and most likely the Lord was unhappy with his behavior and his characteristics. He was a rebel in name, and he was a rebel also in deed. He was the one most likely who persuaded or coerced the people not to move out, not to go to those different places. But let's stay together, he said. Let's stay together in the land of Shinar. Let's stay together and build that tower in Babel. And for that end, he built that great city, Babel. And he rebelled, showing his rebellion, even in his actions. The word Babel, well, friends, it means also Babylon. Babylon. And we know and read about Babylon in the Old Testament. And how the Israelites went into Babylon in exile. But this great, great kingdom, which people thought would never, ever fall, fell in overnight in 539 B.C. It came to an end. It was a magnificent kingdom. But overnight, it fell. In the New Testament, we read about spiritual Babylon. And that's the world. And the world, also, we know, is in rebellion. Isn't it? It's in rebellion against its maker. It's in rebellion against the Lord. It won't submit to its maker. It won't submit to his standards. It won't do as he tells them to do. It won't worship God. But one day, you will hear those words, Babylon is fallen, is fallen, and one day even God will bring to an end the rebellion that is in this world, and will usher in a new kingdom where all will be in subjection to him. But then finally, in verses 21 to 31, we have the families of Shem. And verse 21, again, we've mentioned that. Shem, Moses highlighting and putting, he doesn't want us to miss the significance of Eber. And so he puts him at the forefront of our minds. That word Eber, the word Hebrew is thought to derive from Eber, Eberu. And it's in Genesis 14 and verse 13, we have the mention of Abraham, the Hebrew. And it's thought that this is, well, it's not thought, it's evident that the Israelites are descendant from this man, Eber, and his family. And Eber, we read, had two sons, Peleg, who was born at the time of the scattering. We read that in verse 25. Unto Eber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided. And when he was born, he was given this particular name. And that helps us, because it helps us then to actually date the Babel event. And because of this and the genealogy there in chapter 11, well, we can work out that the event at Babel took place 101 years after the flood. And Noah, out of interest, was still around even when that happened. From Eber's other son, Joktan, well, there came another Semitic group, the Arabs, also, who settled in that area. Well, just briefly, of the other sons of Shem, we have the Elamites, who settled also in Persia, and we have Aram, the sons from Aram, the people settled in Syria, and the Syrians, as you know, used to speak Aramaic, which was before the Greek language took over, the international language of the day. So I say just these things in passing, just out of interest. I hope they might be of interest to you as you read the scriptures. So verse 32, in closing. These are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations in their nations, and by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood. So just a few lessons before we close. What can we say about these things? Well, friends, the whole world is in God's hands. Every nation is in God's hands. But especially the church is what his main concern is. Can we not say that the church is the focal point of our current day history? And even though all the other things are happening in the world and we hear about great things in the news and things happening in other places, yet the focal point of God's plan and God's decree and God's purpose in the world, the thing that he has his eye upon is the church. Just like here, the Lion of Shem, the godly lion, are followed all the way through. So the main reason even this world carries on existing, as we said before, is because of the church and the elect who are still to be brought in. And once the final elect person, the final one who is to be saved, is brought to Christ, well, that'll be the end of the world. There'll be no more reason for the world continuing. But there's also another lesson here, and that is that how God works silently sometimes. All these things happened over hundreds of years. And it took a long time before it became evident what God was doing, and this godly family and Abraham coming. Well, there were hundreds of years before these things happened. And God is still working. It doesn't seem like he's working. It seems like he is silent. It seems like he's absent from history. He's not doing anything. And yet there he is in the background. He's still working out his plans and his purposes, and they will come to pass. And it's the same for us. Well, we know, we look at our world. Is God really working? Is God still working? Oh yes, it may, even if it doesn't seem like it, even if God seems to be silent, He is doing something. And then finally, one other lesson we could take from this is, well, the Hebrews, well, they had to wait a long time to occupy the promised land. It has been suggested that the Canaanites who went to Palestine, well, they were actually hijacked that land. It really shouldn't have been in that land. And maybe they were there as squatters. They were encroaching on land that had actually been reserved for the Hebrews and the Jewish people. And you see how long they had to wait, and the difficulties that they had to go through before they actually occupied and went into Canaan. They had to suffer in Egypt. And that you read about Abraham having to wait. And the people had to wait before they actually went into that land. And yet they held on to that promise. And it could be something similar for us. That we cannot figure out what God is doing in our lives. And we may have to just wait for Him. We have that promise that from God, that He will do us good. That He will work all things out for our good. And yet we cannot see it. And we cannot see things happening. Maybe things are going awry in our lives. Maybe things are going against us. What do we do? And maybe we're also in trouble. But well, let's wait for Him. Wait for Him patiently, friends. As the hymn writer says, His purposes will ripen fast. Soon, in due time, at some point in time, you will see the purpose of God behind even those troubles and those difficulties. So we trust Him at all times because He is worthy of our trust. So just a few thoughts from this chapter tonight.